The serve, sliced, backhand return. Rafa with a backhand volley, and it's over. Game, set, and match. His third U.S. Open Men's Singles Championship.
Sloan from deep beyond the baseline plays a backhand. Keys a forehand. Sloan just hammering away. Now steps into a forehand. It hangs over. Forehand netted by Keys, and Sloan Stephens is the 2017 U.S. Open champion. A warm hug at the net between the two friends.
Here comes a big smile with Sloan. She can't believe it.
Welcome to episode 9 of Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. I'm Nick McCarville, and once again, we have a great couple of interviews lined up for you this week on Courtside. Myself and Steve Flink getting in a couple interviews that I'm sure you're going to enjoy. And first off, that includes Chrissy Evert. She's a legend of the game, an 18-time Grand Slam winner, 6 times, which is still a record, alongside Serena Williams at the U.S. Open, 6 U.S. Open wins. Of course, Chrissy is a member of the Hall of Fame, but Steve first talks to her about her breakthrough run at 16 years young, 1971. And how did that feel to Chrissy?
My first U.S. Open, when I felt like a Cinderella in sneakers out there. You know, I was a giant killer, and I just that feeling of beating all the top women, and it was my coming out party, and I think that has stayed with me my whole career.
Okay, so we're going to get to our interview with Chris Evert here and Steve Flink in just a few minutes, and that is in celebration, as we've been doing all year long, on counting down towards our 50th anniversary. It's the 50th U.S. Open and 50 years of open-era tennis. If you did not get a chance to listen to episode 8, we had a couple really great legends on that one as well. Cliff Drysdale spoke with Steve Flink, and I got the chance to catch up with Arantxa Sánchez Vicario. That's episode 8. You can find all of our episodes on Apple Podcasts. We're also on Audio Boom, Spotify. Anywhere you need us, you can find us there. After the Chris Evert interview, which is about to come up, I got a chance just a few weeks ago in Miami to speak with Brad Gilbert. It's a wide-ranging interview, and Brad, as always, is very forthcoming. He does not hold back, and that's why we love him. Not in his commentary, not on Twitter, and not in this interview either. So that's to come after Steve Flink and Chris Evert.
I'm happy to be joined on this podcast today by a woman who hails from one of the great American tennis families of all time, Chrissy Evert. Chrissy was one of 5 children taught by their esteemed father, Jimmy, at Holiday Park in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. All 5 Evert kids reached at least the final of a national junior championship, but it was Chrissy who succeeded on a level no one in the family might have imagined. Across her storied career, Chrissy won 18 majors in singles, made it to the semifinals or better in 52 of 56 Grand Slam tournaments that she played, and won a staggering 90% of her career matches. At the U.S. Open, she captured the title no fewer than 6 times, a record she now shares with Serena Williams. Chrissy, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Steve, thank you for asking me.
Now, let's start, Chrissy, let's go back to the 71 Open. Now, you had had a stunning victory over Margaret Court when you were 15 in 1970, just a couple weeks after Margaret had won the Grand Slam. But in many ways, you launched your career by that run to the semifinals as a 16-year-old and at the U.S. Open of 1971. And during that 2-week stretch, you had 3 remarkable comebacks against Marianne Eisel, Frankie Durer, and Leslie Hunt. And the Eisel match, of course, was the standout because she was serving for the match up triple match point at 6-5, 40-love in the second set. And somehow you saved 6 match points altogether and won it. Try to put all that into perspective. A 16-year-old playing your first major tournament, having still been combining juniors and women's events that summer, and here you are making this incredible splash in New York.
Well, I was a kid. You know, I was a kid, and it was my first, like you said, it was my first U.S. Open, and I think I'd won the 18 Nationals by that time, and,
yep.
You know, like you said, I'd started to play some women's tournaments, but I think the U.S. Open, that was the start of my career, no doubt, just because the drama of it, and I remember that they put me on center court every single match, which was kind of cool. And my first round was against Etta Budding, right?
Yes, Etta correct. Budding. Correct.
And was that 6-love, 6-love? Or was that 6-love, 6-1?
Yeah, you lost one game.
Oh, it was 6-love, 6-1, right.
Yeah.
But at that time, I think she was the number one German player. And for me, you know, to win that easily at the U.S. Open, it kind of like opened my eyes a little bit to the fact that I could play, you know, with the big girls. But as you mentioned, that match with Marion Eisel, even as I look back now, I don't know how the heck I got through that match. And, you know, all I can say is that I never felt any pressure, even on the match points. You know, I just, it was not a big deal. If I lost, I lost. And I didn't put any pressure on myself. I remember thinking that the ball looked bigger than usual on the, when I was match point down, because I think I was down 6 match points.
Yes, and, correct.
And, you know, again, just I just went for my shots. And I think after that was really the big match. I don't know what would have happened if I would have lost that match. I mean, because I just think that getting to the semifinals at the U.S. Open really set the tone for the rest of my career. Not that I wouldn't have had a great career, but it would be interesting to see what would have happened. It might not have happened. I might not have had a great year or two after that. I don't know. So I got through the match with Marion Eisel, and then I remember...
Do you remember that it was televised, you know, Bud Collins in the booth?
I do remember. And yeah. I've YouTubed it. I've gone back and listened to it, too. It's pretty funny to hear Bud Collins commentating. And then the next round was that... was that Leslie? Was that Leslie Hunter?
No, Francois Durr.
Yeah. And then every match had a drama, because Frankie Durr, after I beat her, you know, she was like in tears. She was in tears on the court because the crowds were so pro me being young and being an American and encouraging me to do well. And she was just so frustrated. She's, you know, a French player. She was so emotional anyway. So I remember she was in tears on the court. And then Leslie Hunt, again, you know, really a serve and volleyer, very much like Marion Eisel, a serve and volleyer and really tough grass court player. But I got, you know, got past her. By then, there was just so much publicity. And I was staying with my aunt and uncle, with my mom and my aunt and uncle out in Larchmont. So I had like, an hour and a half drive. Every day, we didn't even stay in the city. We had an hour and a half drive every day, driving to the U.S. Open and back. And they were making me make my bed and take the dishes out of the dishwasher and do the dishes. And, you know, I was not that I shouldn't, but I mean, staying in a hotel, you kind of have privileges where you're not doing these things. And, you know, I was still living like, you know, a 16-year-old girl, but yet I was becoming a star, I think, that those 2 weeks at the U.S. Open. So by the time I reached the semifinals, I mean, it was crazy. It was really, crazy.
Now, and, were you reading the newspapers every morning or watching the news at
you
night?
You know, I was, but it didn't faze me at all. You know, it just didn't faze me at all. It was like I was winning tennis matches, and that's really the perspective that I had. I was winning tennis matches, and I made the front page of the New York Times. You know, I was like, okay, that's really nice, you know. But in my own way, I didn't get carried away with myself. And it did not put extra pressure on me.
And not intimidated by being interviewed by Howard Cosell?
No, well, that was after the Billie Jean match, wasn't it?
Yes.
Was that after I lost?
That's true.
What was intimidating was going into the press room with you guys after my matches, because, you know, I really wasn't versed on any prep. I mean, I didn't have any preparation for that or any training for that. And it was like people were sticking microphones in my face and asking me these questions. And all my replies were, you know, I felt really good. I didn't feel nervous. And I just went out there and I played well. And I mean, it's just the simplest answers, but you know, I think that was really intimidating, because I felt like I was in a room full of some very intelligent, probing people that wanted to know more than I was willing to give out.
And it was hard not to be a little robotic at times, wasn't it? I mean, you weren't used to doing these press conferences.
No, it was. I was like a fish out of water, and my answers were one sentence, and I didn't really want to talk about, you know, my school and my family life. And yeah, I really, it was like, whoa, you know, you can ask me about the match or what. So that was very intimidating. But my match with Billie Jean, you know, I remember that was really special. And we're walking out. This is at Forest Hills, so, you know, we didn't have bodyguards to walk out. I mean, we walked the whole length from the locker room to center court. And when we walked, there were people on both sides of us roped off. But, you know, there's a lot of people. And Billie Jean, I remember when we were walking out, she said to me, "You're riding on the crest of a wave. Enjoy it." And, of course, as 16, I didn't know what the heck she was talking about. And I remember that.
Yeah, but did you think she was trying to psych you out in a way, or was that just conversation?
Yeah. I thought that she was trying to get into my head a little bit, because as junior players, nobody ever talked to each other when they're walking out to the matches. You know, we didn't talk to each other. So I thought, okay, fine. Oh, thank you. But, you know, now be quiet so I can go play my match. So we went out there, and I remember thinking, you know, Billie Jean, I mean, she beat me by just playing smart tennis. She beat me by slices and dices and topspin and drop shots, and she didn't overpower me, and I don't know, she just outsmarted me. She just took away my rhythm, and I couldn't play my game at all. I couldn't find my timing. She took away all of my strengths, but she was very, very smart about it. And the other women, they just tried to power through me. That hadn't worked. So I think she specifically thought before the match, specifically what kind of strategy, and she changed because she didn't play other women this way. She didn't play other players the way she played me that match in the semifinals. So,
but she didn't really have a choice, right? I mean, I think in a way she felt that there was no alternative, because if she didn't mix things up and if she wasn't creative, you were going to beat her.
No, for sure. I'm complimenting her on how smart she was and the tactics that she did use. And it was, again, I was surprised that she was hitting the ball soft, and I was surprised that she was hitting it with a lot of slice. But as the match went on, I realized as I looked at the scoreboard that it was working. So I didn't feel like I got blown off the court, but I felt like I definitely got outsmarted. And then when I lost that match, then I was interviewed by Howard Cosell, and again, the press conference was another intimidating press conference. But, you know, that it was a Cinderella story, you know, quite frankly. I mean, that was my first tournament that, I mean, what a great tournament to blossom at and to come at, to having a coming out party at the U.S. Open, your own country's championship. You know, couldn't have been more ideal. It couldn't have been more perfect for me. And ironically, I was invited the year before when I was 15 to play the U.S. Open, because that was the year I won the 18 Nationals when I was 15, and the 18 National champion got right into the main draw. And I remember my dad turned and said, "No, she's not ready." So he thought I was ready that year when I was 16, and he was right.
Absolutely. Well, Chrissy, you were still an amateur that year in 71. You didn't turn pro until you turned 18, but could you have envisioned at that stage this soaring prize money, this game that was taking off, particularly the women's game, because the Virginia Slim Circuit had really just started that year. The nine players had signed their contracts in 70, and now in 71, the year that you got to the semis of the Open, that was the first year really of the tour. I mean, could you have ever have envisioned then at that age where everything was headed?
No, but remember, I was only 16, so it's like I had lived the circuit before that. You know, I really wasn't that familiar. All I was familiar with was junior tennis and then women's tennis for just a couple years. But no, I wouldn't have envisioned it to have taken off the way that it did. But again, my dad, who was my coach and my father, made all the decisions for me at that time. At 16, I wasn't really educated and aware, and I didn't see the social aspect of what women were going through and equality, and I didn't understand that, you know, the women were receiving 10% of the prize money of men. I mean, I thought, you know, I understood it, but I just thought women athletes are relatively, that was kind of a new concept, and they'll work their way into it and get equal prize money sooner or later. But at that point, it was so uneven. But again, I was so young that I am protected that I didn't know the full consequences of the movement, what was going on in the early 70s with women.
So you went home, but you obviously when you left the Open.
Oh my gosh, I went home.
You're trying to digest it all, and did you really feel pretty soon thereafter that your life might have changed forever? That was a lot to get a hold of.
Yeah, I felt it did for sure because I went home, I flew home, and the whole school came out to meet me at the airport. So I guess so. You know, the band was there and the school was there. And as I got off the plane, they announced, Chris Everett, please wait until the end, you know, the last person to get off the plane. So I got off last and I went back to the school and I had to make a speech. And the next day, Life magazine came to my class and took pictures. So I knew at that point that my life had changed and that I was going to be under the microscope. I mean, even at that young of an age, I felt like I was going to be living under a microscope from there on in.
Well, no doubt about it. I mean, you had become a celebrity very, very swiftly mm-hmm. there. But let's move ahead to this your first victory at the Open in 75, because by then, yeah, your career had totally taken off, and you're number one in the world, and you'd already won a couple of French, and you'd won Wimbledon in 74 the year before.
Yeah.
But now this was the year that the U.S. Open switched to clay, or Hartshoe to be more exact, and you hadn't lost on clay for a couple of years, and it all came down to this enthralling three-set final between you and the carefree Yvonne Goolagong, and you fought back to win it 6-2 in the third. Talk about the gratitude of winning your country's championships for the first time, and also the sight of your mother sobbing in the stands when it was over.
I know. Oh, my heavens. I remember, first of all, playing Yvonne was always tough because she's such a wonderfully natural athlete, and I find myself watching her, the way she moves and the way she hits the balls with such grace, and I had to keep telling myself, watch the ball, don't look at her. She was such a great player, but winning that, I did feel pressure in that match because I always thought that I was a better clay court player than Yvonne and that I should win that match. But after I pulled out that match, I remember looking up and seeing my mom, not with a few tears, but sobbing. And I was like, whoa. And I was the kind of player that, you know, I kept everything in and I didn't show emotions. And I looked up and I saw her sobbing and I'm like, that's probably the way I should have been feeling, but I wasn't. But I realized how much it meant to her to have her, to see her daughter, you know, win a major championship. And I think, that took precedent over me winning. It's just seeing that. I really, it still is with me today.
And what is also was that wasn't there a sense of relief too, because you were such a heavy favorite because it was on clay, and even though Yvonne was a very good clay court player, the fact remained that everybody was sort of expecting you to do this, and you were down a set, and it was 4-all in the second set. It was tight. And then
you knew that. Were you there?
Of course, I was there. I was there up in Portal 7 with most of the other reporters. But no, I mean, it was.
What happened to 4-all? Was that an easy game for
you? Not an easy game. But, you know, you really did pick. Wow. Once you turned the corner in the second and you had some struggles early in the third and then ran it out those last four or five games. But I remember feeling watching you that early evening that there was a lot of weight on your shoulders because of the expectations. Did you feel that?
Absolutely. As I said before, that match I did feel pressure. Because exactly, you're exactly right. You know, I had such a great record on clay, and I was the clay court queen, and had a much better record than Yvonne, and she was known more for the grass courts than for the fast surfaces. So I did feel pressure. And then coming into New York, my own, you know, home championships, and I'd won Wimbledon, and I'd won the French Open, which were over in Europe, but now, like you said, it was time. Since it was on clay for me to win the U.S. Open. So I did definitely feel pressure. And I felt like for that first set, I remember feeling that I wasn't, like I said before, I wasn't playing the ball. I was playing Yvonne. And I was sort of letting her dictate the match. And instead of just playing good, solid clay court tennis, something that I, you know, since I grew up on the clay, I knew it was there. But it took a while, I think, for me to find my game. But once I did, like you said, you know, I was fine, and that was a nice way, a 3-set win over Yvonne. You know, that was a nice way to get my first U.S. Open title. Also,
now Chrissy, that pressure was off after that breakthrough triumph that year, and then you took the title again the next 2 years, and as expected, to beat Goolagong in 76 and more easily, and yeah. Yvonne was pregnant, right?
She was.
Yeah.
Which we learned afterwards. Yep.
Just, right.
Yep. Very much. Yep.
So that was an easy 6-3, 6-love. And then you beat Turnbull in 77. And then after that 77 tournament, you leave Forest Hills. You'd played 7 years in a row at Forest Hills and come to enjoy it, first on the grass and then 3 years on the clay. And now you're leaving this Tony private club to go to Flushing Meadows in a big new public facility. What do you remember about your feelings about that move? And obviously also going on to the hard courts, but mainly the move itself into an entirely different setting.
Well, first of all, Forest Hills was very, very charming. Very, very small, very charming, very homey. And it was kind of sad to leave because, as you said, I'd played there for X amount of years and you become used to the place. And it was just very intimate. You know, the center court was very intimate. Then when we moved to Flushing Meadows, my first impression was cold. It was cold. It was like, you know, all you saw a lot of concrete. Again, it just didn't have a heart yet. It didn't have a soul yet because it had no memories. You know, I walked in there feeling that lack of warmth, but also knowing that tennis had grown so much and the spectators needed more room, the players needed more room, we needed more courts. Tennis was a big business, starting to become a bigger and bigger business. TV from all over the world, you know, the TV trucks. We needed so much more space than Forest Hills had to offer. And it was a new era. It was after the 70s boom, you know, and now Jimmy Connors was on the scene and Billie Jean and myself and McEnroe and they're just, you know, Bjorn Borg. And it was just, there's just a lot more going on and there is a lot more excitement surrounding tennis. And it had gotten so big that, you know, there's no choice but to look ahead and to create a bigger venue for tennis.
So you won that inaugural Open over there, and it's an exciting match against the young 16-year-old Pam Shriver. And then the next year, your big streak came to an end because you had won 4 Opens in a row, and along comes Tracy Austin to beat you in 79. But a year later, 1980, you celebrated one of the most significant victories of your career when you beat Tracy coming from behind to win 4-6, 6-1, 6-1. Then you had a similar kind of comeback against Manlikova in the finals. Put that Austin win in context, because in my mind, it was one of the most crucial of your career. And talk about how you did it and the surprising advice you got from another player's coach.
I have 2 pivotal matches in my career, and this was the first one, beating Tracy Austin. You know better than I do my record. Had I lost to her 5 times in a row?
You had 5 in a row.
I had lost to her.
Starting with that Open the year before, and then she won 4 more after that.
I had lost to this young Tracy Austin 5 times in a row by this U.S. Open. And I really was starting to think negative thoughts, like, okay, this young girl is more hungrier. She's hungrier than I am. She's faster than I am.
Let me just interject for a second.
Oh, geez,
okay. No, I'm just going to recall something you said to me that ties into what you're saying now.
Okay.
And we were driving from the Whiteman Cup back to your Fort Lauderdale. We were riding together, and we started talking about Tracy, and that was in the fall of 79. And you said it kind of reminded you of McEnroe with Connors, in that here were these young players coming along, and they had this look in their eyes, this sort of fearless look. And I could tell that you had this sort of sense of Tracy, that she was completely sure of herself, no doubts, and it didn't spook you, but you were deeply concerned. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I had been on the tour 7 years, and, you know, I don't think I was as hungry then as I was when I came on the tour 16, 17 years old. And I saw that in Tracy. I saw hunger, I saw, you know, she was quicker, she hit the ball harder, and she was fearless. And, you know, after 7 years of being on the tour and being number one, you definitely feel pressure. You know, when you're on the top, you feel pressure. So I, and then you feel double the pressure when you play somebody young. And she was only, you know, she was young. So I lost her 5 times in a row, and I was in the players' room the day before, and Don Candy, who was Pam Shriver's coach, was sitting there, and I just sat down beside him because Pam was a good friend of mine, and Don, I really liked Don a lot. And he just looked at me casually and just said, "So how are you feeling?" I said, "Good." And he said, "How are you going to play her? How are you going to play Tracy tomorrow?" And I said, "I'm just going to play my game." And he said, "Well, if you play your game, you're going to lose again." And I looked at him because he's so blunt. That answer was just so blunt. And I go, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "Well, you know, you're not going to beat her playing the way you have the last 5 times. And that's been, you've let Tracy control the match. You've let her control the point. You try to play like her. You try to match her ground strokes and her timing and her power." He goes, "You know, she's unbelievable from the baseline. She's beaten Martina. She's beaten you. You know, she's the greatest at the baseline." He said, "You're going to have to play outside the box, basically. You're going to have to change your game. And you're going to have to go for winners sooner. You're going to have to mix up the pace, get drop shot, you know, da-da-da, come to the net. You're just going to have to mix it up and kind of jerk her around the court a little bit and not let her get into a rhythm," which is entirely the opposite way I played tennis. I mean, I played very neat and very consistent and very solid tennis. But I thought about what he said, and for some reason, that's the way I played the next day. I went out there.
But you didn't start that way.
No. Well, I did. But I just wasn't completely comfortable with it. I mean, it was at one point, was it 6-4, the first set?
Yeah, but she was up 4 love. You made a nice comeback in the first set.
Yeah. But I did. I didn't even know that. But I think for the first 4 games, I was probably going for shots and missing, you know, maybe making more errors than usual. But I knew that once I caught up, it was like you said, it was 4-all, and then 2 close games, but I lost 6-4. But I thought to myself, okay, I didn't even play a great set, but I did what Don kind of suggested that I do. I'm just going to keep doing this. I'm just going to keep it up. And sure enough, I got my game going in the second set, and I started drop shotting, and I started going for second serve returns, and I came into the net a little bit more than usual. And I sliced, and I got her off the court so she couldn't show her strength. And
then you got the crowd. You got the crowd behind you too. I mean, they were cheering pretty vociferously there as you turned the corner.
I didn't even notice the crowd.
Yeah,
but I very rarely notice the crowd because I was concentrating, but I remember winning that set 6-1 and then the third 6-1. And after that, my perspective of my style changed. And I knew that playing the way I had until I was 24, 25, however old I was, it wasn't good enough, that there's a higher standard now, and a new crew of young players are going to come up, and the bar was going to be lifted a little bit higher. So I had to change my game according to that. So that was something huge in my career.
But then you had to bounce back from that emotional triumph still play a final the next day against Amanda Kova, who wins the first set. And then in similar fashion, you come back and beat her 6-1, 6-1.
Well, you know, I just like to, you know, keep people in suspense. No, I was, I have to say, early in my career, I think I was a slow starter anyway. Until I got going, until I started losing, then I'd get mad, and then I'd play better, you know, because I'd use that as fuel when I got. Sometimes I'd go out there a little bit too comfortable and not like fighting, you know. I would just want to see how it goes for a few games. But, yes, then I came back, and that would have been really disappointing if I went all that way with Tracy and then lost to Hannah. So I won that U.S. Open. But
well, those kind of things could happen, right? I mean, think about that.
Yes.
Because at Wimbledon earlier in the summer, you beat Martina, Martina had beaten you in the 78 and 79 finals. You beat her. You're about as happy as I've ever seen you after a big match. And then you lost to Yvonne in the final.
I know.
So it can happen.
It can happen. That's one of my more disappointing losses, that Wimbledon, because I really felt like I didn't prepare mentally or emotionally well enough. I took Yvonne too lightly. So you're absolutely right. But winning that U.S. Open, I think it's even more than the title. I think it was beating Tracy that meant more to me because I changed a losing game, you know, and I made some adjustments and I played out of the box, and I just had to go in an unknown area in my game, you know, and take chances and knowing that I was going to make errors, unforced errors, but still believing that that's the way I needed to play to beat her and to get to that next level. And I think after that, I had a good record. I mean, I think then I beat her.
You beat her a few more times after that. It's true. Went back and forth, but you had a couple of nice wins over her. 2 years later in 82, you beat Andrea Jaeger, who had been giving you some problems, and you beat her very easily. And then beat Hannah Mandlikova this time in a much easier final than the one 2 years earlier. So it was a pretty, you were pretty much at the top of your game that event. And that was your sixth and final U.S. Open, but not necessarily the most memorable. Is that right?
I think that I was very happy when the U.S. Open changed from grass courts to clay courts and then hard courts. Let's put it that way. You know, I think I felt really comfortable on those hard courts. And I think it is the U.S. Open. Yes, the crowd really spurred me on. But I also think I felt comfortable on that surface. It was a pretty equal surface for everybody, you know, for serve volleyers and for baseliners. And I did enjoy playing on the hard courts. So, I mean, I think that was one of the reasons why I've had success. I had success the last few years at the U.S. Open. But no, I mean, I think my first U.S. Open, you know, that was the fairy tale. And then winning my first U.S. Open, beating Yvonne in three sets, and then the U.S. Open that I beat Tracy. I mean, those three probably are...
They stand out.
You know, the highlights.
Now, I'm going to bring up a different kind of highlight, sort of a bittersweet occasion. September 8, 1984. You were part of what many of us believe was the greatest day in the history of tennis because started off with Stan Smith beating Newcomb in the senior final, Lendl rallying from match point down against Pat Cash in the men's semis. Then you go out there, and then you're followed by McEnroe and Connors in a five-set classic. But you played Martina. And Navratilova, your great rival, and you win the first set. And I remember you're saying that the crowd was cheering so loud it was ringing in your ears. It was one of the biggest ovations you probably ever received at the Open. But Martina came back to win the match in three sets. Talk about the emotions, because I know after the match you did tell a few friends that it might have been the perfect match to retire on. I mean, it was an agonizing loss at the time, but on the other hand, you were part of a spectacular day. Put it in perspective.
I said that I might want to retire.
Yeah, you did. You said you thought it would have been a great match to retire on, meaning it had you won it. You weren't gonna quit losing it, but that you had you won it would have been kind of a nice fair. That was, and who knows, that might have been just a fleeting thought anyway.
I remember it was a great day, and I sensed the excitement in the crowd as I walked out, because you know, that men's match had been terrific the match before. And I remember winning the first set against Martina. And as you said, the crowd was deafening. You know, they were clearly on my side. And she won the second set. And I remember in the third set, I actually was pretty close with her for a while. And then she broke away. And I remember feeling as very, very disappointed that usually... You know, I took that loss hard. I took that loss hard because I was in such a position to win that match, and I didn't get bold. You know, I didn't take enough chances.
You know what? You're absolutely right, and I'm going to bring you back to a key point in the second set, because you'd won the first, and you had a chance to break back, get to 5-all in the second set. She had, you know, you had her in at staying back on her second serve. and you hit a forehand, just steered it long down the line, and you were not happy with yourself because it was one of those points that could have made a monumental difference to get back to 5-0 in the second set. So I think that sort of confirms what you're saying to me. You got cautious there.
I think even more so in the third set, I think that it wasn't that I missed. It was that I let her hit the winners. You know, I didn't take that. I didn't take the court away from her.
No,
I didn't
that's
dictate
true.
The points. And I got very cautious and careful when I could have gotten to another level. You know, I could have gone up a little bit and played a little bit bolder tennis. And I think that was, I was so disappointed in myself that I didn't do that, that I didn't have enough faith to do that, that I didn't have enough belief to do that. And, you know, that's what I was very, very disappointed. Because I remember when I went up and shook hands, I couldn't even look at her and I couldn't smile. And it was one of the few times I've shook hands and didn't look my opponent in the eyes and wish, you know, say congratulations because I was just so upset. So, yeah, that was tough. That was tough. But, you know, again, you learn from your losses. And, you know, I think as the older I got and the more into my career I got, I realized that I couldn't play cautious tennis anymore. And so a match like that is going to trigger something in me to make me realize that not to do that again in a close match. And I think that it worked that way.
Chrissy, when you got to the U.S. Open of 89, we're going to jump ahead here 5 years.
Okay.
You had decided in advance that was going to be your last tournament. You knew you were going to play Fed Cup after the Open, but this was the last major, and it was something really fitting and right about it because you'd basically launched your career at the 71 Open. Here you were 18 years later, and you're saying that this is where it's going to end for me. You're coming full circle. And you in the round of 16, you played one of your best matches in years. I'd say it was one of your most stellar performances of the second half of the 80s, beating Monica Seles, love in two. But then, sure enough, you play Zena Garrison, and you were not the same player, and you lost in straight. Talk about the emotions of going out that way, the kind of buoyancy you had after winning against Monica, and then the sadness after losing to Zena and waving goodbye to the crowd and knowing this was it for you at the U.S. Open.
Well, I have to go back. That was 89. I have to go back to 88 because 88 is really when I start thinking retirement because I was starting to, after being on the tour at that point for 17 years, I was starting to be in and out of matches a little bit more. And my mental focus was, I think, what my biggest strength. And as soon as I lost...
You sure about that?
Started,
are you sure?
The mental part of my game.
Whoever said you were mentally tough?
Oh.
No, go ahead. But no, seriously, you.
But you're challenging me there. No. It wasn't my big serve ball.
No, I'm just kidding you. But no, that's absolutely right. It you were having more days where your mind might wander and where you couldn't count on yourself the same way by 88. Is that right?
Yeah, and I was like, I was waking up in the morning and not wanting to jump out of bed and go practice and. Or jump out of bed and not wanting to play a match. And I was like, oh. So I really started to feel it, and it was kind of a heavy feeling. And I remember talking to Andy Mill. He was the one that said, milk it as long as you can, because once you leave it, you're never going to get it back. And you don't want to look back and regret that you maybe would have another year or two.
That was good advice.
And so, because he was an Olympic skier, and he had to retire because of injury, so he never had that luxury of having that choice. So he saw what I was going through, and I thought, okay. And then I met with Bob Kane, my manager, and we decided that I'd play one more year in '89, and we'd announce it. And then every tournament, I could, you know, say goodbye to every tournament that I played. By the time it got around to the U.S. Open. You're right. I played one of the best matches in my career, really, against Monica Seles, kind of using that same philosophy against Tracy Austin, taking chances, getting Monica out of her safety zone, drop-shotting, kind of jerking her around the court, very much like Billie Jean King played in my first match with her at the U.S. Open.
Yep.
Maybe I ended up playing my best tennis at the U.S. Open. I started playing the younger players the way Billie Jean played me. And then I played Zena Garrison, and you know... Wasn't I up a set? I was up. I won the first set.
No,
correct?
You should have won the first set.
Was up 4-1. I was up 4-1.
Yeah, 5-2 also.
But I was up 4-1, right? Come on, got to give you that.
Yeah, okay. I'm giving you that.
4-1, 5-2, okay. And then I let it slip right through my fingers, you know, for no reason at all. And the reason why I wasn't really disappointed when I lost the match was because that's the reason why I retired. Because I was having more and more matches like that, where I wasn't focused and I wasn't as hungry and eager. And so basically it wasn't really a disappointing match. If anything, it was a relief and it was time for me to move on in my life. And I had played as long as I could. Now, in saying that, I went and played Fed Cup after that and played great, you know, against Conchita and Arantxa. But you know, it was time for me to retire, and that's why I didn't feel bad when I lost that match. And also because Zena was a nice girl.
Oh, absolutely. No, it was a nice moment at the net, the hug at the net, genuine embrace from both of you. But, you know, you played, it's remarkable looking back, the 19 straight years, 71 through 89, and never did miss the quarterfinals at the Open, only missed the semifinals twice. Was that long-term consistency, such as the 52 out of 56 semis or better at all the slams, was that what you're most proud of as you look back?
That is what I'm most proud of as far as consistency. You know, I was interested and I was engaged in every match that I played. And I don't know if that's something if that's a gift or if, you know, I don't know. I don't know if you can teach that. I mean,
I don't physically, think you can.
No, I don't. And it's just like the physical. I mean, I also think I realized that I wasn't the natural athlete that a Martina was or a Steffi Graf was or any of Billie Jean. And I realized that I had other attributes that could compensate for that. And that was my head. And that was mentally in my mind. And I could play every match, every point like it was match point. You know, and a lot of players with tremendous talent, they go in and out of matches mentally. And so you can take advantage of that and get a lot of free points from these players. So I think that I did the most with what I was given, you know, both physically, mentally, and emotionally. I certainly can say that I was married to my tennis. You know, I gave it the emotional commitment, the mental commitment, and the physical commitment. And I gave it all I had. And that's, I think, what I was the most proud of, too.
Can you reflect all these years later on your role as such an important part of the tennis boom, you know, emerging in the 70s when you did, and being what some people call the cover girl of tennis, but getting all that attention, but the sport getting all that attention as well?
Yeah. You know, all I can say is the 70s, I'm so glad I came up in the 70s with Billie Jean as our mentor and as our leader, leading the way for equal prize money and equality for women. And what I loved about my role is I think if I did anything, I encouraged young girls, 5, 6, 7 years old, to come out and play the sport, and that it was okay. It was respected. It was feminine. It meant power, you know, that it's everything positive is associated with, you know, being a girl and being athletic. And I think before that, there was stigma about women athletes. So I think there's just a lot of good lessons in the 70s.
You come back every year now, Chrissy, to the Open. There were times in the past you did your corporate appearances, but since 2011, you're coming back because of ESPN and your commentary. And what strikes you the most as you when you come back and spend those 2 weeks and cover the event as a TV reporter? About the growth and visibility of this major sporting, I mean, have you reflected on what it's become from the days when you started off in the 70s to where the U.S. Open is now, nearly 50 years later, in your case, 47?
Obviously, there's been a lot of changes in the game and in the, especially, you know, the business side of tennis. It's a lot broader, and now countries from all over the world are playing and are interested as far as TV rights and the exposure is just tremendous. You know, as far as the athleticism, I think the players, I marvel at, you know, how hard they train. I mean, in our day, in the 70s, we didn't train like Olympic athletes. You know, the sport was relatively new, and women athletes were relatively new, a new commodity. And I don't think the men trained either, like Olympic athletes. And now tennis players are in tremendous shape, and they're probably one of the fittest athletes out there. So I marvel at the physical, I think, commitment they've given to training and the long matches. I mean, it's very bittersweet, because I can feel what it feels like. You know, I know what it feels like for these players to play a really tough three-set match, and then they have to come back the next day and play another tough three-set match. It was like watching Simona Halep at the Australian Open, you know, having
three or
four three-setters in a row, and this little body, she's just, you know, she has to work so hard because she's smaller than the rest of them. And I remember I remember how that felt, and I remember how the pressure felt, and so I can relate to a lot. But it's just more intensified now, you know. But it should be, because they're getting a lot more money. You know, the money's a lot bigger, the intensity is a lot bigger, the physicalities is a lot better, and the exposure is a lot better. So it's just become tremendously a very potent and popular sport, and you know, I still love to be around it.
In this 50th anniversary year of the Open, what do you miss the most about playing all the majors, but particularly your country's championships, as you reflect back on your career?
Playing a night match in New York at the U.S. Open was very exciting, unlike any other Grand Slam. I mean, center court at Wimbledon is really special, but it's not exciting special. Exciting is playing at night at the U.S. Open, and the people, having the New York crowd come in and watch you play and cheer for you because you're an American. And I don't care how you're feeling, I could have 102 fever and I go out there and I'd feel the vibes, and it would make me play my best tennis. It would inspire me to play my best tennis. New York crowd is very inspiring to American players, and it's just very exciting. It's like sport, but it's also showbiz, you know, when you're out there. So the atmosphere, I just miss the atmosphere when I'm out there. That's an adrenaline rush that you don't really find a lot after you retire. So it's just really, really great being an American playing at the U.S. Open. It's very special.
Can you narrow it down when you look back on the Open? Is there one favorite moment? I mean, we talked about the Tracy match, but I mean, that's a tough one, but is there something that sort of just hits you quickly that maybe has stayed with you from all those years of competing?
You know, when I think of the Open, my first U.S. Open, when I felt like a Cinderella in sneakers out there. You know, I was the giant killer, and I just, that feeling of beating all the top women, and it was my coming out party, and I think that stayed with me my whole career.
Well, Chrissy, thanks so much for spending the time and talking with us today on this podcast. It's been a lot of fun for me to get your recollections, and most of them were accurate.
Well, you know, it just comes down to the same thing. You still know more about my career than I do, and I feel like a dummy sometimes when I'm talking to you, but thank you for being so interested in my career. I appreciate it, and being a good friend, Steve.
All right. Thank you very much, Chrissy. Same to you.
Chrissy is absolutely right. No one knows her career. Probably no one knows the history of tennis better than Steve Flink. What a wonderful interview. I loved all the different iterations of her career, talking about the transition of the U.S. Open. There's so many details that she recalls, and Steve Flink did so well to recall those with her. And how about Chrissy having to wash dishes during the U.S. Open in 1971 when she made that run? Those are the little anecdotes that I absolutely love athletes sharing with all of us. And Steve Flink, kudos for helping us get that out of Chris Evert, and thanks, Chris Evert, for joining us. Next up, it's Brad Gilbert. This interview was a few weeks ago at the Miami Open, and Brad doesn't hold back. As I said earlier, he talks to us about his nicknames, about some next-gen ATP players that we should be on the watch for. I love diving into his coaching philosophy. Obviously, he's worked with incredible players like Andre Agassi, Andy Roddick, Andy Murray. But he really opens up about what he thinks works, how the game has changed, and then he's got an interesting point of view on why he loves the modern iteration of the U.S. Open. It's not even to include main draw play. If got to listen towards the end of the interview. And here is that interview with Brad Gilbert.
Brad Gilbert, let me ask you first, how do you, because you're prolific first off on Twitter, we'll get deeper into your Twitter in a minute, but how do you follow the sport of tennis? Because there's a lot to follow for a commentator today. How do you make sure you stay on top of all the goings-ons?
I'd like to think that I'm just a complete lifer. my wife thinks that, like, I'm a knucklehead besides Twitter and, you know, live scores and... You know, there's so much information available. I don't feel like I ever, you know, all of a sudden just check out. Some people, like, all of a sudden they're done with an event. Maybe they're not working one for a while. I literally look at results, and I follow the sport every day. And Twitter is a great way to find out, like, you know, a lot of information. I still, believe it or not, like, all of a sudden I'm calling a match today. I'll go back to YouTube, which is... insanely good. And all of a sudden I want to watch a match where two guys played, you know, from 2 years ago to kind of look at you. So I do that. So I do a lot of studying. It's great. There's so much access.
I think some of us in the younger generation, we call it a deep dive, right? You fall down a rabbit hole. YouTube, Twitter, social media. Do you ever do that where you just get lost in YouTube clips and highlights and just feel like, oh wait, where did those last couple hours go?
I hate to say I'm probably guilty of that.
Okay.
As well.
That's okay.
You know, for me, like, certainly 20, 30 years ago, this stuff wasn't available. And it's amazing. People will send me matches of when I played. Where the hell was that? I don't even remember it. You know, from, you know, a guy just recently sent me some matches from the late 80s from Cincinnati. It's like, where the heck are you even finding that? But I do like to study some of the matches that I call, and you can see two or three other matches from the last 3 years, and you kind of start to look for trends and stuff. I think it's a great vehicle for watching and learning.
Yeah. So now we'll talk a little bit U.S. Open. Obviously, I want to go back to your playing days, to Andre, to Andy, that sort of stuff. But who are a few of the guys? We saw Young Chung play today. We're chatting in Miami. Who are some of the young guys on tour that you're really, really excited about? Because this generation has been trying to break through, and they're still trying to break through.
Well, I mean, obviously the Big Four has wiped out quite a few generations.
Yeah.
But I think it eventually... you know, something has to give. I really like the Canadian. I like Denis Shapovalov. I think that he is a very fascinating guy to watch. He's not a huge guy, but yet has a big serve, and he's fun to watch. I also think the other Canadian, Felix Amin, has a chance to be a very good player. I think Chung may be potentially in a couple of years has a legitimate chance to be a top three player. He's much bigger than you think he is. A little disappointing the way he played today. I still think Zverev can get a lot better. And the one that I can't believe that hasn't gone to another level, he just can't stay healthy and get committed the way he should be, is Kyrgios. Because I still do think that he has the potential to be winning slams and be a great player, but he just hasn't found the balance of being able to do this day in and day out.
So you mentioned a couple of guys there, Zverev and Kyrgios, two guys waiting to break through. But what I want to try to understand, and for people out there, is how and why is it so hard for these guys? Because we saw Zverev do it last year. He won two Masters 1000s, but then he can't break through at the majors. So what is it about this generation? Their challenges are so tough to get to that next level.
Probably like anybody under 25 hasn't grown up without a cell phone. They're, you know, since they've been six or seven years old, they have a cell phone. They're always looking at the cell phone. So your attention span, you know, maybe you're not as locked in. And so you see kids that are like that age, like as soon as they have a break, their head is in their phone. A lot of older, like people, you know, you didn't grow up with a cell phone or a computer. And so your attention span is longer and longer matches. I do think that Zverev has the talent. If you can win in 1,000, I think that you should be able to win. But the big thing is, like what happened to him in the Open last year, expectation. He's not flying under the radar. You thought he could win it, and then all of a sudden, played another young guy, loses the Chorich.
Yeah.
Since that match last year that he lost, he's been barely above 500.
Yeah.
It's been a little disappointing. So this is his best tournament in a while. But I do think, believe it or not, like from practice and some habits, I call it a little bit of cell phone syndrome. You know, that you when you're on the court, no looking at the cell phone. But I do think those two guys that you brought up, Zverev and Kyrgios, they have tremendous talent. It's just a matter of being able to put it together and do it in a two-week tournament. And for Kyrgios, more than anything, he's got to learn to be healthy. How is he going to be healthy, and how is he going to improve his shot selection? Last night, 6-4, 2-all, first ball, start the game, shot through his legs. You know, those are great every once in a while, but not all of a sudden when it's in an important time. Shot selection and being healthy has got to be fixed for Kyrgios.
Well, the health we know comes from off-court work, from being in shape, but what you're saying with the cell phone syndrome is it's not really about the talent, because you've seen it with Kyrgios and Zverev that they're so talented. What you're saying is it's the focus and the mental fortitude, which has been so impressive from the Big Four and from this generation that's hung around for so long, that they've been able to be so tough in the big moments.
There's no doubt. I'm not going to call it the, you know, pre-flip phone and all this stuff.
T9.
But I do think there is something that kids now don't watch a game. They literally speed through highlights. You know, so, you know, your attention span changes. Like, when I grew up, you had to watch a live sporting event. There was no finding out about it. You got to sit there. And there's no expediting through it. And there's something for that in tennis that you got to learn to be locked in to playing in best of five for potentially 5 hours. And the generation with the cell phones, everything is bada bing, bada boom. Everything is so fast. They want to watch a game in 10 minutes. They just want to watch the highlights. I want to watch the whole game.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you've got to play the whole game to win it, right?
Absolutely.
We mentioned your Twitter at the beginning, and you use it as a tool, but you also use it for a lot of your nicknames that people who follow you will know them very well. Walk us through that process. How do you come up with a nickname, and what makes a nickname stick for especially these new guys that we're getting to know?
Like Borna Identity?
Yeah, I like that one. Kyrgios Kyrgios?
I mean, so the thing is, some names, obviously, phonetically, you have a lot more to work with. Young Chung Tonight. And then some names are tougher that things don't come in. Like to me, people think I have some sort of a staff. I just kind of look at names and sometimes things just pop in your head. Sometimes I get people to smack on me. They don't like the nickname. You know, one guy I saw yesterday loves his nickname, Silent K, Hatching Up. He's, you know, and then you, sometimes you'll get somebody, you know, I don't like that nickname. Why do you call me? You know who won? He's not crazy about his nickname because he thinks he should be Chapo. I call him Chapstick because the way he plays, he, you know, he's from Canada. He looks like he'd be, you know, making a slap shot from the blue line. So he's Chapstick. So, you know, you'll get some players that complain about it a little bit, but listen, it's my account. It's my, as long as I'm not offending anybody, people can take exception, people can love it, but that's just who I am. I'm just having a little bit of fun.
Brad, where'd that come from? Because if I'm right, I mean, Bud Collins was kind of the nickname giver in tennis for years, right?
Well, Bud was a little like a thespian. Yeah. He would like to, he liked to do the, he would give some nicknames, but a lot of times he would kind of make a name like Navratilova, you know, like, I just kind of, it's just me. It's just who I am. I like to have fun with it. I'm not going to say, like, one of my favorites when I was a kid, Vic Braden, the backhand, the forehand. Remember Vic Braden?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I just take a little shtick from somebody, and I just have fun with it.
You know, when you coach Andre Agassi, he won six majors, six of his eight in his career. Obviously, we're looking back at the Open era. You played through a lot of it. He played through then that sort of next generation. Why did you, or how were you able to bring out his best tennis? Or did you, I don't want to say you lucked out, but was it the perfect confluence of great coach, great player, and you guys worked well together?
Well, your wife's sometimes biggest fear is you become your dad through osmosis. You pick up all these crazy bad habits. I'd like to think of I became a little bit of my coach, Tom Shivington, and I just told him that he had to work with me, and I got to work with Andre. And I like to think of I'm a Chevy truck, and I kind of see things a little black and white. Working with Andre was an amazing gift. He's a great person. He's a complicated genius. I think we worked really well together. And I felt like when I started coaching Andre, we started here in 94. I felt like so often playing against players who were not nearly as good as him, he was always trying to be perfect. I said the pursuit of perfection doesn't exist. It only makes you miserable chasing it. You just need to be solid, and you're going to beat a ton of guys. And that's what he kind of learned to do, because he always thought if he won 2-1, it should have been better. I'm like, you know what? Win and move on. You know, it's not about, you know, beating everybody. It's just about beating somebody that specific day and strategizing for that. I thought he had so much God-given talent. It was just about more about maximizing. And I enjoyed the journey with him because when I played, I never thought about winning slams and, you know, planning out my schedule. Every week was too important to me. And learning to be with him, I kind of saw through someone else's lens, okay, what we need to do to get better and peak for slams. And so it was fascinating to go through ups and downs. I wish we only had ups, but the great thing is we did it all. We went up, we went down, serious? We went up all over the place. But it was a great journey for 8 years, and you know, still to this day, we still talk all the time, and he is one quality person. And I say about him, he's probably doing better things now than he's ever done. He's changing kids' lives. He's a great person.
So you work with him from 94 to 02. You pick up Roddick right before he wins the U.S. Open. Eventually, you work a little bit with Andy Murray as well as Andy Roddick. For you as a coach, obviously going from a player through, what, 95 was your last year, 94, 95, to then coaching that late 90s era into the era really that we see today, were there different strategies with those guys in trying to bring out their best tennis?
Well, first of all, my little one, my daughter Zoe, says that I could only coach somebody that had a first name that started with A. Otherwise, you got no hope. I'd like to think of, no matter who I work with, I'm not a coach that it's like my way or the highway, or I only have one philosophy and everybody's going to mold to that. Each player that you work with has strengths and individualities. And what I like to say, the day that I start working with a new player, it's a blank canvas. It's day one, and how are we going to maximize what they're doing? And my whole thing is, it's, you don't talk about you're going to win slams, you're going to win this, you just talk about, okay, whatever your dreams are, we're going to try to fulfill them. And we're going to try to get better, and it's day one. But you don't talk about, like so many people, how many slams you're going to win, when is the slam, when are you going to get to this ring? Everybody's aware of it.
Yeah.
But what you try to do is just get better and keep it simple. And each player, you don't compare them to another player. I don't want Roddick to start playing like Agassi or Murray and vice versa. You work with the player and you say, okay, this is what we want to get better. This is what we need to do. And you don't compare them to somebody else. It's just, it's no favor to anyone to do that.
Was there one common thread? I mean, other than the A first name of those three guys, is there one thing you can pull out that say Andre and the two Andys did rather similarly?
Well, the key sometimes to coaching is have somebody make you look good. All of them had tremendous talent. I like to think of, as a coach, even though I was a player, most importantly, it's you look through their lens. It's not what you see through your own eyes. Now you're looking through. All of them had great skills. All of them were great athletes. But completely, I'm telling you, did you ever see the show Let's Make a Deal, Door 1, Door 2?
Yeah.
All three couldn't have a different personality.
Hmm.
But what you're looking for in a coach is to tap into something, each one of them, and find something. And try to, you know, your whole goal, I always just say this, is to try to get them a little better. And however you can push the buttons to make that happen, sometimes it takes different work with each one of them.
Why no more coach? I mean, you coached, I think, up as recently as 2012, 13. Why aren't you coaching anymore?
I guess, you know, one thing about life, never say never, awfully happy at the moment at ESPN, not having to travel so much. All I can do is make a bad pick here and there. I'm really happy with my life. I like coaching like a little bit, you know, I do, I had a court at my house in San Rafael, I do some gigs, but you never know if it will happen again. If I do, I kind of like to go all in. I don't like to do, if I do it, I would go all in, and then it's hard to do that and do the ESPN. I kinda, that's where right now I'm at a point in my life that I travel probably between, I'm going to say 81, 82, and probably up through, you know, 2002, at least 250 days a year. And I probably had, you know, at maybe 10 to 15 years, 300 days a year. So I've got a lot more time to spend at home with the missus, with the kids.
Yeah.
So now my kids are older, but we have a great team at ESPN, so it's been a lot of fun. I really enjoy it. I can't pinpoint it and say I won't, and I can't say I will.
So 50 years of open air tennis, 50 years of the U.S. Open. I want to know for you, personally, your own best U.S. Open match, because you had a few of them. I have one I think you're going to say, but what do you say?
Of my own?
Yeah.
Man, the older I get, the better I used to be.
What about fourth round, Boris Becker, 87, you're down two sets to love?
Pretty good one on the grandstand. Yeah, that was a good memory. And even later in my career on the same court, I think in 93,
okay,
first round, maybe eight or nine rain delay, started 11 o'clock in the morning, finished about 1:30 of the night. I beat Stitch in five sets. Fast forward 12 months later, my big speech, all of a few seconds, right before Andre is going to go on the court and play the guy a year later in the finals of the U.S. Open. It's like, dude couldn't beat me a year ago. How the hell is he going to beat you? And Andre looked at me and said, okay, went out and thumped him in straight sets. So that's what you, but honest to God, anytime I had a win was a good day for me.
Yeah.
I mean, those,
it's
you
a good
know,
day for anyone.
It's a good day. And like, I wasn't good enough to be like Andre and, man, be miserable sometimes. I beat somebody, and it's like, could have been better. I'm like, man, any win was a good win. But as a kid, honest to goodness, I just dreamed about playing there. And we didn't have information like you do today. You didn't get to see all these matches on TV. You just knew that I want to go one day. I had three goals. Like, and my dad told me, I was like 10 years old, you're going to play Wimbledon, you're going to play the Open, you're going to play Davis Cup. Okay, great. You know, he's telling me that and I'm 10 years old. And it's like, but you think about it. Hell, man, when we were 12, we would think about indirects, how many indirects it would take to beat a Laver. I got this guy, I beat that guy. But just to play.
Yeah.
And even today at 56, the first day that the tournament starts, that I walk through the gates of Wimbledon or I walk through the Open, I still get that special feeling that the first time I went there, and I don't ever take it for granted. And I do think that when you take walking through those places for granted, then all of a sudden, you know what, maybe you need a reality check.
Okay, last thing I want to ask you because of this 50 years is I've been asking a lot of the players about what's special about the Open and, you know, night sessions and the electricity, but you experienced the Open in the early 80s, maybe before that, all the way up through and into the iteration we know it today. What have you watched it change, or how have you seen it become the tournament that it now is?
Okay, first of all, it's become beyond like 2 weeks of the Super Bowl. I mean, I played there, I remember, 81. I'm playing the qualies. I'm yelling over on the side courts. The damn burger smell was like flooding our court. I mean, and there was like so many courts that were like field courts. They weren't like, every court now is like an individual court. And you felt like, you know, the New York crowd is a different crowd. And every once in a while, a crowd could get on you. They could love you. They could lift you up. The energy, the intensity, the passion. I would definitely say the first time that you get a chance to play a night match, it's a completely different energy than any other situation you'll play in a major. And to see the improvements the tournament's made over the years, just from the practice courts to each individual court, there's something about taking a subway sometimes every once in a while in right to the ground.
Train,
yeah, you know, just all of a sudden you just want to take yourself back to a reality check, go just take a nice subway train ride in. It's a great experience. And I still, to this day, like when I kind of look back and all of a sudden I kind of feel like, where's my mullet when I came there? Where's my short shorts? Where's my high socks? Now it's long shorts. It's no socks. I'm bald. But I still love that joint. I love seeing what they're doing there. New stadium. Everything they got going there. You know, I love it. I want to see even more like access for the fans at home.
Yeah. Well, we're biased here at the U.S. Open podcast. I would say if anyone out there can get to the first, I love what you just said about the first day of a major. There's nothing like it. It feels like the world is at your fingertips, the excitement around it. And I think that's why, or that's how you know you're in love with tennis.
I'm going to tell you, even a better ticket than the first day. The best day to go to majors is in the qualies. You go, like my older brother lives in New York. Like, he's going to go, like, to watch the first and second round. Because your whole goal is, maybe if you see somebody and say, geez, I saw this kid. And then maybe 3 years from now, can he be top five? Can he be competing? So it's finding or seeing that match of an older player playing a younger player, and then maybe walking around seeing some of the great players practice. So my favorite time as a player, coach, now commentator, is that week before when you see the qualies, and if you get a chance to see a young player, someone's talking about, did you see such and such, this 17-year-old kid, and watching, remember last year, Denis Shapovalov play the qualies. That's what people, you know, are going to remember and think about, because I saw such and such, and I knew he would be top five.
And free at the U.S. Open.
It's a free ducat right there. You know, you can't spend money at the concession stands unless you get in, but it best week of the tournament, the week before. And I almost feel like now, as a major, it's not a two-week tournament. It's a three-week tournament. With all the stuff they got going on the week before, I love that week.
Yeah, awesome. Hey, well, thank you for the time, and thanks for letting us bother you
all
for
good,
a little
buddy.
Bit of insight.
And, you know, if you come up with anything on Twitter, you know, I'm always available, but remember, I'm a one-person staff. I shoot down tons of people when they, you know, feel obligated on my Twitter nickname.
And how do people follow you?
I'm BG Tennis Nation.
There you go.
Okay, buddy.
Well, you heard the man. If you have nickname suggestions for any players, tweet at him at BG Tennis Nation, and hopefully he'll hear you. He'll read those. Thanks to Brad Gilbert, and a huge thanks to Steve Flink for getting Chris Everett, his good friend and a tennis legend, to speak with us. That was an incredible interview. You can listen to us on Audio Boom, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or really, I think, anywhere you find your podcasts. This year, all year long, we're celebrating 50 years of open-air tennis, 50 years of the U.S. Open. And as we move to spring, we're into the clay season. It'll be grass, and then soon it'll be the U.S. Open Series and the 50th U.S. Open. We'll be ramping up our coverage, giving you great interviews. And don't hesitate to give us feedback when we put things out on social media. We want to hear from you. Thanks for having a listen to Courtside. I'm Nick McCarville, and we'll talk to you again very soon.